This is Shai Held. Thank you for joining us for this podcast. A quick note before we start. Most of these episodes were recorded before October 7th, so even though it's very relevant to a lot of our discussions, you won't hear us talking about it. Welcome to Answers Withheld, a podcast about the big questions that kids, and let's be honest, adults too, ask about God, Judaism, and our place in the world. We definitely do not have all the answers, but we hope we can help you with language and framework so you can engage meaningfully with these questions. I'm Rabbi Shai Held. Today I'm joined by Rabbi Jill Jacobs, my very dear and very, very longtime friend. Jill is the CEO of TRUA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights, and at the risk of embarrassing you, I think one of the most important Jewish leaders and thinkers in America. And I am privileged to call you a very close friend. Jill, it's really good to see you. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me. It's really wonderful to be here with you.
Today, we're going to ask how we can raise kids who care beyond themselves and their family. And I want to say a sentence about why I invited you to have this conversation. I think of you as someone for whom being part of a Jewish community is so essential to who you are in every way. And at the same time, you have been in the Jewish community for several decades now, this incredibly forceful and insistent voice about the universal horizon of Jewish life. And I specifically wanted to avoid the temptation that I think is common, which is to pick one. You know, I'm particularistic, so I care about my community and let everyone else fend for themselves. Or I'm a universalist and I find all particularity fundamentally offensive or outdated or, you know, whatever, the vestigial of some, you know, more primitive time. You really hold those two identities together. And at the risk of asking you a very strange question, I found myself wondering as I was driving here, after all the years that you've been doing what you're doing, do you find this question easier than anyone else?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on. It's really just an honor. And we've been having many conversations for many years, so it's really wonderful to be able to have this more publicly. For me, my commitment to universalism is definitely rooted in the particularism of Jewish community and Jewish text and Jewish history. One can say, I am a citizen of the world and my relationship to everybody is exactly the same. And if I'm going to give money to people who need it, I'm doing it because I'm a nice person, because I care about the world, etc. But Judaism offers something that's much more particular, which is to say, first, I'm very rooted in my identity, and that's important. And I have a primary community that I'm part of, or concentric circles of primary communities. And it also says that when I'm making decisions about how I engage in the world, that I'm looking to Jewish texts, which are effectively thousands of years of very smart people talking to each other about how we're supposed to build a just society. And there's a lot that we can learn from that. And what we can learn from it is not just general ideas like be a nice person. I mean, that's there also, but it's very, very specific ideas about how we're going to engage with our community that for me give a richness to the work that I do. And also, I'll just say personally, working in human rights is not easy at all. And it's very important for me personally also to have a ritual life through prayer, through Shabbat, through holiday observance, through being part of a community that is both sustaining and also reminds me that I'm not in it alone either in terms of there's other people in it, but also that I'm in it with God, that there's a certain hubris that can come to being an activist or doing human rights work. Like, I could just work harder and I could do everything myself. But then we have, why do we bother praying to God for all sorts of things about how we want God to interact with the world, or why do we take off a day for Shabbat? Some of that is a real check on the hubris of thinking that just we human beings, being the best people we can fix everything.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful. I mean, you know, when I was researching my forthcoming book, one of the texts I came upon that really, really moved me profoundly is a section in a book by Rabbi Yaakov Emden, one of the great rabbis of the 18th century, who argues, I think correctly, that in Leviticus, love your neighbor refers to fellow Jews. It's very clear in the structure of those verses, I think, that loving your neighbor is something that you do for those who are fellow members of the covenant. But then just when you think he's made this kind of particularistic argument, he then says, but there's another mitzvah, which is to love every human being because they're created in the image of God. And what I found so moving about that was that it was this incredibly simple and straightforward way of saying, there's a certain love I have for my people, but that love can't become the only love. I also have to have love for human beings as such, right? Loving humanity is easy, loving humans is hard, right? The old cliche, I think that's really important. And of course, conversely, I can say I love all human beings, but then I don't have a community where my love is rooted. I mean, one of the things I think is really fundamental, one of the reasons I think that partiality, the idea that we favor some people more than others with our care, is we learn to love in profoundly partial ways. We learn love from our parents, no matter how imperfect they are, from our siblings, if we have them, from our friends as we get to know them. And I think Judaism as a philosophy and a worldview works with the grain of nature rather than against it, right? I think Jewish thought basically says it would be counterproductive to tell people, you know, the love you feel for your children or your neighbors or your friends, that has no real moral worth. That's just, you know, that's just like natural. No, what Judaism ends up doing is saying, grow from that love and then open it outwards. So partiality is, I think, in Jewish thought, the path to universality. The challenge then becomes, and I have no doubt that you have a lot to say about this, the challenge becomes how to prevent family first from devolving into family only. And that seems to me to be on some level the moral question of partiality. Yeah, I'm supposed to feed my child before I'm supposed to feed yours. But at what point do I stop pampering my child so that I can feed yours? That is the really hard question, I think. For me, that question is almost paralyzingly difficult.
Well, thank you for sharing that text. That's a really amazing way of thinking about this. And what it made me think about is that the idea that human beings are created B'Tselem Elohim in the image of God is the very first thing that we learn about human beings at all in the Torah. It's our very first introduction to ourselves, and it's, of course, before there's any Jews or anybody else, before we're divided up. But the command to love your neighbor comes later. It comes to the Jewish community. And I wonder, and there's other commands that come before there's Jews, right? There's commands that come to Noah, and it is striking now thinking about it that perhaps we weren't able to receive the command to the mitzvah to love another person until we had that community to base it in. But of course, it's all in the backdrop of every single person, Jewish, not Jewish, anybody is a creation of B'Tselem Elohim exactly equally to anybody else.
I want to take your point and go one step further. One of the things that biblical scholars have shown in the last generation that is really striking is that in the ancient Near East, cultures tell creation stories that culminate in the creation of the culture telling the story. So in the Babylonian Enuma Elish creation story, the culmination is the creation of Babylon. The Bible does this wildly countercultural thing, which is that ancient Israel, our people, tell a creation story in which we are not primordial. That is to say, it culminates in the creation of the human being, not in the creation of an Israelite. This is what John Levinson calls the universal horizon of biblical particularism. It's almost like the Torah is going to go on and defend and celebrate and valorize, whatever word you want to use, particular identities, but it's not going to do it without first establishing universal humanity. If you don't establish that, particularity can just go bananas, as we know, in dangerous, toxic ways.
Yeah. One of the texts that comes up for me a lot is very famous Mishnah in Sanhedrin, and it refers back in that text to the story of Cain and Abel, where God says, the bloods of your brother, plural, it's important for the interpretation, are crying out to me. And then it goes on to say the very famous thing that's on, you know, greeting cards and posters and things like that, that anybody who destroys one person, it's like they destroyed an entire world. They're responsible for that person's life and any future generations that would come from them. And there's, in many printed editions of the Talmud, the word of Israel, right? One soul of Israel gets added in, which is not originally in the text. And we know that both from manuscripts, but we also know it because it doesn't make any sense, because of course, Cain and Abel were not Jewish. And this principle of responsibility for one another is a a principle that goes back before there's Jews, before there's a particular Jewish community. But you can see even on the page that struggle with some people coming in and saying, no, 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 this only actually applies to Jews. We don't have that responsibility. But that's actually entirely unnatural to that text.
Right. So let's stay with that for a minute. So how do we prevent a robust sense of community from devolving into a sense of total insularity? How do we help kids have a horizon that goes beyond their most immediate relationships, their communities, their friends, their schools?
Yeah, well, I'm not going to pretend that I figured out this parenting thing at all, or that I...
Join the podcast.
Yeah, but certainly, I mean, in my family, it's very much about talking about what's going on in the world and also living out our obligations both to our community and the broader world, which means that I want my kids to come with me to a shiva house. I want them to understand that. I want them to come with me to drop off food to somebody who just had a baby. I want them to feel like now that I have one kid who is above bat mitzvah age, I want her to show up and make a minyan. And so that is really important, that they understand that they're part of a particular community and they have particular relationships to people, even people they might not know personally, but who are part of this community. And it also means that I want to take them to protests, and I want to make sure that if we're passing somebody who's asking for money on the street, that we're giving money. And it also means that we're involving them, especially as they're now a little bit older, in tzedakah conversations. And that is, for me, the tzedakah conversations are one of the main places that I think really specifically about obligations to both the Jewish community and the broader community. So when I think about a Talmudic text about, well, it's about loans, but loans are really part of tzedakah, that in the choice between somebody who is wealthy and somebody who is poor, you prioritize somebody who is poor. Your city, another city, you prioritize your city. A Jew and a non-Jew, you prioritize a Jew. And there's one way to look at that, which is saying, all right, let me look at all of the people in the world. And first, I'm going to divide out all the people who don't live in my city. And then from my city, I'm going to divide out all the non-Jews. And then I'm going to be left with the Jews. And then I'm just going to give to the poor Jews. That's one way of reading the text. But there's another way of reading the text that I prefer, which is to say these are all overlapping categories. So what if the Jews in your city are less poor than the people who are not in your city and are Jewish, or less poor than the people who are in your city and are less poor than the people elsewhere who are Jewish, or right? So these are all overlapping categories, and there's not an answer. I mean, unless, you know, we have all the money in the world, which certainly my family does not, we're saying, okay, well, when we're making our tzedakah decisions, let's talk about what percentage we want to go where. So we give a higher percentage, let's say, to Jewish causes than the percentage of Jews in the world, but it's not the majority of the money that we're giving out. And we give a higher percentage to Israel, and specifically to fighting for human rights and democracy in Israel, than we give according to the size of Israel compared to the rest of the world, but we also give to the rest of the world. And there's not a fixed formula, and there's not a perfect formula. We certainly haven't gotten it. But what's really important for me is that we're having that conversation. We're saying that we do have particular obligations to the Jewish community, but they're not our only obligations.
I want to introduce a comment that Rabbi Menachem HaMeiri, one of the great medieval sages, makes. When we are taught, Aniyei Ircha Kodmim, the poor people of your city come first, Meiri's comment is, please notice that comes first means that there are people who come second too. Meaning comes first does not mean comes exclusive. When I say that X comes before Y, I am saying I also have an obligation to Y. And he goes out of his way to underscore that it is a mitzvah, it is unequivocally a mitzvah, to also support Y. I mean, he thinks, you know, he sees that in the language of the text itself, which I think is interesting and sort of, it's powerful in its simplicity. So one of the things that I've come to think more and more the older I've gotten is that religion at its best is not often about giving answers. It's about giving us better language for our questions. And one of the things that you said that I thought was really kind of moving is, you know, what happens when, okay, there's someone who I'm more distantly connected to, but they're poorer or in more urgent need. Many of us are familiar with the principle that, you know, my family comes first, the poor people of my city come first, the poor people of my community come first. But there is a midrash, in Midrash Sifrei on Deuteronomy, that offers an explosion of that whole discourse. It says, ta'ev ta'ev kodem, whoever is neediest comes first. And once you say that, you realize that what was neat in principle is totally messy in practice. Because what happens when my community is poor, but another community is starving, right? It's no longer clear from those texts that my community comes first, right? Now, on one level, I find this conversation exasperating because I want to know what to do, right? And on another level, I find it really helpful because it sort of names the impossibleness of this whole conversation, of how incredibly difficult it is. Hopefully, that is motivating rather than deflating, which is, I think, another of the challenges that, you know, we might talk about, which is how do you raise kids who look at the enormity of suffering in the world and are moved to care rather than be completely deflated, right? That question is everything on some level.
It's a really hard question. And I think about the thing that people, if you go through a media training, they'll tell you that the number at which people stop caring is 2, meaning that if there's a newspaper story about one kid who's in some kind of crisis, people will send money to the newspaper to give to that kid or write in and want to donate or adopt them or whatever it is. But if you write a story about 2 kids in a situation, there'll be nothing. And it's a challenge because people are motivated by those stories. They're motivated by encounters with an individual who has a particular story. And also, you want to then zoom out and be able to say, well, there's actually big systems that are causing this particular person to be in this situation. And also, you're not going to solve the whole situation by trying to take care of this person. So that's a really hard challenge. And I also really like the idea that what Judaism or probably any religion gives us is the questions, because I don't think we're going to come up with answers. Even when we talk about tzedakah in Judaism, most of our texts are talking about it in a very small community in which we know who needs the money and in which somebody can go around and tell people how much they're supposed to give. And we can kind of manage to take care of the people more or less in our community, which is not the situation we're in this world where we can read about what's going on in any country around the world. And it's very easy to feel entirely powerless given how much need there is. And so the question, which doesn't have an answer, is how do we find that balance between how do I connect with particular individuals? How do I connect with particular stories? How do I feel like I'm contributing in a positive way and not feel so overwhelmed that I do nothing without losing what the whole story is?
You know, it's interesting. My friend, Rabbi Ozer Glickman, who died tragically very young, who was a teacher at Yeshiva University, Ozer had this really interesting article in which he argued that if you look at both biblical and medieval Jewish sources, you find a kind of subtle insistence that the ultimate tzedakah encounter is interpersonal rather than philanthropic, right? That the paradigm case is you're struggling, I offer you assistance. And then the derivative case of that is people are hungry, I give money to Oxfam or, you know, or whatever it might be. And one of the questions that I find myself thinking about is, well, I find the question so hard that I don't even know how to ask it. But in a world where there is so much hunger and poverty, how do I maintain, on the one hand, the focus on the interpersonal encounter of giving while really being insistent on not staying there, right? Because I think on some level the danger is staying there. And, you know, the fact is 99.9% of the people in the world who are hungry, I will never come across their path. So what happens with that?
I'm thinking also about just personally how I do tzedakah. So there's a guy in my corner who I see every day asking for money, and I give him $1 every day, and I don't know what he does with it. It's not actually my business. He does something with that dollar. And I know that if I were going to sit down and say, how do I strategically end hunger in New York City, let alone the whole world, giving him $1 is not the way to strategically end hunger. But I don't want to be the person who walks by him and doesn't even see him and doesn't care enough to give him $1. But it's not where, when I sit down with my family to do our communal tzedakah and we're actually putting the money that we've set aside for tzedakah, we're doing that, I don't know if it's the most strategic, but at least we're trying to have a little bit of strategy, or we're trying to think about who are the groups who are doing good work and how are we balancing New York, the rest of the world, Jews, not Jews, et cetera, et cetera. So it's important for us to say, well, we're giving to organizations that are trying to end poverty, that are trying to end mass incarceration, that are doing good justice work in the world, but I'm not going to allow the fact that we're doing that to let me just walk by this guy who actually needs a dollar and to say hello to him and remember his name and actually interact with him as a human being.
You know, one of the most powerful experiences I had with someone who was asking for money, I was living in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I think it was Friday night, and a man asked me for tzedakah, and I said, you know, I'm really sorry, but I don't have anything on me. And he said, thank you for looking at me. Thank you for looking at me. And I feel like that is really on some level fundamental. And I can say that because it's not like I succeed at that all the time. This Lord knows there's plenty of times I'm in a rush or I'm running or I'm caught up in my own whatever. And I don't see people. The Talmud says in this really extraordinary passage that smiling at someone is better than giving them milk. Which is a really kind of strange thing to say. What are they actually talking about? And the Maharal, Judah Lowy of Prague, comments on that passage. He says, that's because you need milk to survive. In the same way, you need to know that someone sees you. It's actually as elemental as a baby needs milk. Human beings need to be noticed. And I think that that's the piece that we don't want to lose when we think about global poverty. We don't want to lose the face of an individual child who's hungry. We don't want to lose the face of the person who lives on my corner who doesn't have a coat. So, Jill, we live in a society that has done a very good job of accentuating individualism and individual rights. How do we, knowing how badly we need a counterweight, how do we get to a society that really balances a sense of individuality and individualism with a really robust sense of moral responsibility, or better, solidarity, human solidarity? How do we create human solidarity?
That is a fantastic question. I don't know if I know how to get there. I will say that I think Judaism, Jewish texts, the way that Jewish community is constructed and also described is a counterweight to the kind of radical individuality of American society, where everybody feels like it's every person for themselves. When we talk about freedom in America or rights in America, it's the freedom from or the right to do whatever I want, which is actually not the way that we talk about human rights. For example, in human rights discourse, we talk about human rights as what people can have the right to demand from their society and from their country. In the United States, we have the sense that whatever you're going to do, you have to do it by yourself. And people who succeed often feel like they did it themselves without recognizing all of the infrastructure, all of the privilege, all of the government investment in their, whether it's their education or whether it's the roads that they drive on or whether it's the fact that their family, that their parents went to college, right? It's very easy to say, whatever I've earned it myself. And therefore, I don't owe anybody anything else. And maybe if I want to be nice, I might help out some people. And Judaism is really countercultural in that way by saying that we are part of a community. We have responsibilities for our community. There's no prohibition on getting rich in Judaism, but there is a prohibition. There are lots of rules about how you treat your workers, how what you have to contribute to the upkeep of your community, essentially that you can't get rich by just trampling on everybody else. And there's, I think about discussions like, for example, in the Talmud, a discussion about, well, how long do you have to live in a city before you start contributing to its upkeep? So after 30 days, you're giving to the tamchui, to the soup kitchen, and then longer, you're giving to the more general tzedakah fund, and longer than that, clothing, things that people maybe don't need to live for that day, but they need them longer, and longer than that, after a year, you're giving to the communal infrastructure to actually make sure that the city is a safe place to live. And that's really pushing us to say, you can't just say, you know what, I'll just build a wall around my house, or I'll just take care of myself and my family. I'm not really part of this place. I'm doing my own thing. That as soon as you're in a place for even a short amount of time, and certainly when you're there for a longer amount of time, you have certain responsibilities that everybody that are shared among all of the people there. And it's just very countercultural to the way that we think in the US. And I don't have the answer to how we can repair the social fabric in the United States. I think we saw certainly during COVID, initially there was some language in the first few weeks, maybe some language around we're all in this together and it's equalizing and we're all equally vulnerable. We learned very quickly that we were not all equally vulnerable, that some of us were comfortable in our houses and working from home, and others of us were out working very dangerous jobs where we were exposed or had different levels of health concerns. And then we saw also in many of the debates that happened, and debate is maybe a nice word, that there were some people who felt like, I don't have any responsibility toward anybody's health because I want to do what I want to do right now. And certainly other people who felt like, even if my health is okay, I do have responsibilities toward other people. And it was just really a moment of seeing that we don't have any ethos in the United States of we're all in this together, we're responsible to each other, we actually care if other people who we don't know die as a result of our actions. And I think that Judaism can be a counter to that, can't maybe fix it. But again, in the theme of Judaism gives us maybe more questions or more openings for discussion, this is a way that we can open a discussion to say, well, what does it actually mean to live in a community? What are our responsibilities to people in this community who maybe we don't even know?
I want to stay with this idea of Judaism as countercultural for a minute, and I want to add a kind of theological and spiritual dimension to it, right? If you begin with a sense of gratitude for the gift of life, a sense that you are not your own creator, then on some level, you live with a sense of obligation, a sense of indebtedness. This is, I think, part of what Abraham Joshua Heschel was getting at when he says, what we own, we owe, or I am what is not mine, meaning I didn't make my life. I didn't create the breath that keeps me going. You know, I didn't manufacture my organs, right? On some level, it's a gift that I did nothing to deserve. It's grace. But that comes with expectations, right? One of the verses in Tehillim, in Psalms, and part of Jewish liturgy that I think about most is the phrase, Ma'ashiv la'donai kol tagmulohi alai. Right? How can I repay God for all of the bounty that God has bestowed on me? Now, that's a very theological formulation. I think there are probably also less theological formulations. How can I repay all these gifts that I did nothing to earn? And frankly, what are the moral implications of being lucky? This is a question I have to say, the hardest moral question for me. I've been thinking about this question for 30 years and feel like I've made very little, if any, progress. What are the moral implications of luck? I could have been born into a starving family in Sri Lanka, and I was born in Rockland County, you know, with enough food and a shelter over my head and all that. What are the moral implications of luck? What I'm trying to get at is that I think Judaism orients us to a sense of obligation in a really powerful way. Or I should say, Judaism can orient us to a sense of powerful obligation, because religion can always be reduced to feeling that God blesses me in my comforts. But that's the kind of religion ideally we want to overcome, right? It's a religion that has expectations, that makes a claim on me. One of the Talmudic sages, Ben Azai, says that Genesis 5:1, this is the book of the generations of Adam, Ze Sefer Toldot Adam, is the great principle of the Torah. And usually what people say is, oh, what he's really alluding to is the image of God that is the second half of that verse. The second half of that verse is something like, you know, when God created the human being, God created him in God's image. But one of his explanations is very different. He says, this is the book of the generations of Adam is a way of reminding us that we are actually all family, that to be a human being is to be everyone else's cousin. That is a kind of theological framing of solidarity, that if I really take seriously the notion that I come from God and so do you, then we are related to one another. And I find myself thinking a lot about how do I cultivate a sense of real human solidarity? That child who comes from a family that speaks a different language, that worships God in a different way, that maybe has different political opinions, that child is my responsibility. Not in the same way as my child is my responsibility, but still that child is my responsibility. That child is my family.
Yeah, it's a hard question. And how do we maintain that sense that I have responsibilities to that child without making it so fuzzy that I feel like I actually don't have responsibilities to anybody because it's too general?
Right. That's it's a great formulation.
There's this debate that I come across a lot because I work in human rights, and I'll hear people say, well, human rights, that's not a Jewish concept, right? Rights aren't a Jewish concept. Jews have obligations. We don't have rights. And for me, when I read the beginning of Bereshit, the beginning of the book of Genesis about B'Tselem Elohim, that is, in a sense, that is saying, well, we have certain claims, right? We are created in God's image, whatever that might mean, which means we have certain claims on dignity, but it also imposes certain obligations. It means that we also have obligations, right? Like, together with that, God gives us obligations and responsibilities for the world. And when we think about rights in the world, in the world of human rights, yes, we all have certain basic human rights that we get by virtue of being human, but somebody has to give us those rights. And so in international human rights, those are the countries that we live in. So every state has responsibilities for the human rights of the people who are in that state. And in Judaism, we're not talking, at least in classical Judaism, we're not talking in the language of states and big governmental organizations. We're talking in the language of community. And for me, Tzelem Elohim is really two-sided. It's two sides of a coin, the sense that because we're created in the image of God, we can basically demand anything, any way that we think that God should be treated, we can demand that, right? The ultimate dignity, the ultimate worth. And it also means that just like God has agency, we also have agency and we have responsibilities for ensuring that other people are treated with dignity. And that gets very specific. It's not like Judaism is kind of like, be a nice person, treat everybody as a creation in the image of God. But we have a whole system of laws that gets developed, that's still being developed, that is about very specifically how do we create the kind of society where people are treated as creations in the image of God. So I think about that. The other thing that I think about is the word achicha, which shows up at various points in the Torah, your brother, we could say your sibling, to be a little more expansive. And it tends to show up in places where you wouldn't necessarily think about that person as your sibling. So for example, somebody who has done some crime for which they're getting lashes, the Torah refers to them in one place as a rasha, as a wicked person, and then later as achicha. And there's a beautiful midrash that says that, well, before they finished their punishment, they were considered wicked, and then afterwards, now they're your sibling again. And really challenging you to see that person who maybe you don't want to run into in a dark alley. Maybe they did something really terrible, but especially that person who is not your friend, you might not want to have them over for dinner, but you have to see them as your sibling. And the same when the Torah talks about poverty, that the person you give to is called achicha again, that maybe that person is dirty and smelly and who knows, talking to themselves in the streets. We don't know anything about the person, but the challenge is don't just take care of them monetarily, but you have to actually see them as your sibling, which is much harder than seeing, let's say, your best friend or your actual sibling as your sibling.
I want to ask you about whether you think that the particularism, universalism dialectic that we've spent a lot of time talking about, is that meaningfully parallel to me and my family or my family and the family across the street? In other words, are there versions of that that take place even within a home? It's a very different kind of question, but it's related, meaning, you know, I really want to do this now, but my kid really wants me to do something else. How do I balance what I feel I need for myself versus what my child wants from me?
So again, I have not figured out this parenting thing. And it's for sure a balance that parents are dealing with all the time, right? Our own needs and desires and our kids. And I am not going to try to propose what a formula is. Obviously, as parents, we have some basic obligations to try to keep our kids as safe as possible and fed and to help them try to grow into independent human beings. And so I don't think there's a formula to at what point do I follow my desires and what point do I follow my kids. And I also think something I think about a lot, particularly when my kids say, why are you going away again for work, or why do you have to go to that event or that protest, is that for me, I also think about part of my role as a parent is to ensure that my kids don't think that they're the center of the universe and that there's other things that are also important to me, that of course they are in many ways the center of my universe. And there's times that I'm not going to be with them because I need to go and do something for my work or for volunteer work or for for whatever reason, I'm going to do something that I think is contributing to the world or that's trying to create more justice in the world. And in that moment, they have to recognize that that is also important and might take me away from the thing that they really want right now in this moment.
You know, it's interesting, though, because you went to two obligations that you have to the world, which obviously totally resonates for me. But I wonder about obligations you have to yourself. I mean, I'll speak personally for a minute. I feel this question with a particular poignancy as someone who lives with chronic illness, in that there are times when I have to say to my kid, I have to take care of myself right now. I cannot go play baseball with you. First of all, I physically can't. And second of all, there are things that my situation requires me to do right now. And I wonder, here also, we tend to run into like two simplistic categories. One is my kid comes first, and no matter what I do for myself, I'm falling short just in the very nature of doing that. The other is the kind of narcissistic parent who's like, well, I do whatever I want, right? And how do I find a way to say, yeah, my children are the center of my universe? I like that language. You know, I would say my children are the center of my universe, but they are decidedly not the center of the universe. One of the things we like to do on this podcast is conclude with a series of important questions, give people something to take away with them. So I want to ask, what do you do when your child articulates a position that is hyper-particularistic that you find problematic and even offensive? I only care about Jews. I only care about my community. I only care about my family. I only care about myself. How do you respond to that?
I would respond first with a question. Why do you say that? I want to know for myself what I did wrong that my kid is saying that, or what they're responding to. And then I might try to talk about the values of our family or why we make certain decisions. I would talk about why I have a different approach. But then I would also want to think broadly about, well, who am I exposing them to and what kinds of communities are they in and what do I have to do differently so that my kid not only doesn't say that, but actually feels like they have an obligation toward the broader community.
The thing that strikes me about that question is, how old is the kid who's asking? And are they asking from a place of defiance or pain? In other words, I want to know what is really behind that question, right? A kid who said to me, I only care about Jews, might be a kid who is angry at me about something, because they know that that statement gets under my skin and is antithetical to my own values. So my first question would really be, like, what's going on right now? Like, what is at stake in saying that for you? I hope that would be my response. That would be my best response. Because I'll tell you that when I first think of that question, my impulse is to say, I hope you know that that is a profoundly un-Jewish thing to say. Now, that is a singularly unhelpful response, right? Although there's a version of that that is actually quite useful, which is to say, you know that part of what it means to be part of this people is to care about more than this people. Part of what it means to be a Jew is to care about everyone. But if I was responding to the question, I think it would take me a while to get there. I would really want to understand what's being asked. And the truth is, I think that's true about parenting in general. So often, when a kid asks you a question, the first response ought to be another question to understand the question they're asking. Right? Because there are thoughts they're having, there are feelings they're having, there are experiences that they are consciously or unconsciously processing.
Yeah. Or I want to know, did something happen in the world? Did something happen in school? Was there an incident? Where is that really coming from? I've also learned over 14 years of parenting almost that first to ask the question and second to answer the question that was asked and not to answer the next question that's in my mind. Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. maybe the kid is actually not on that next question. And in this situation, they're not actually asking a question, but in our conversation, I want to make sure that I'm in the conversation that they're in and not in the conversation that's going on in my head.
And that requires real attentiveness. And that's really fundamental.
Well, I'm curious how you as a parent think about raising your kids with a sense of responsibility to their community, to broader communities, how you think about raising them so that they don't end up in an insular place.
Yeah, I find this question really hard, and I don't know that I'm successful at it. I think that the answer to this question for me is like the answer to a lot of questions, which is, first and foremost, you model it. I read a line recently, I forget where it was, that really spoke to me. in which a philosopher says, kids don't practice what their parents only preach, which I found really, really moving and helpful. So in some ways, I feel like modeling caring about other people in concrete ways, like bringing a meal to someone who's sick or who's sitting shiva or whatever. But even kind of what do you talk about at your dinner table, right? What do you discuss and make clear is important to you?
You can't lecture about community. You have to demonstrate it and live it and have kids follow your example, whether it's we're going to go to a shiva house, even though you might not know the person, but I know the person, or they're part of our community, and so we're going to show up. We're going to drop off this meal. We're going to drop off food or go clean out the community fridge that's on our corner because that's available for everybody who's walking by who might need food. We're going to go to this demonstration, which is going to be hot and long and boring and downtown, but we're going to go because it's important. So for me, it's very much about modeling that and hoping that either they'll follow the lead or they'll rebel. There's a certain point that I can't control it, but at least trying to set that example. And then I think about what it means to both live very deeply in Jewish community and as observant Jews and also be part of our greater world. So for my family, it's meant that we're deeply involved in our shul. My husband's the rabbi of the shul. We're observant. We're Shomer Shabbat. We keep Shabbat and Kashrut and et cetera, et cetera. And our kids go to public school, which means lots of negotiating all sorts of things having to do with Kashrut and Shabbat. It also means that they are in multiple worlds and understanding that not everybody's family lives in the same way as our family does, and understanding that lots of people have lots of different experiences. And hopefully, I don't know yet if we've done it right, but at least the hope is that that means that they are growing up feeling like they have multiple communities they can be part of, and they have obligations to different, to people who are very similar in many ways to our family and to people who are not similar in many ways to our family.
Thank you so much, Jill. This was, as I expected, lots of fun and very enlightening.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure.
To all of you listening, thank you so much for joining us. We hope you'll join us next time for another installment of Many Questions and Answers Withheld. Answers Withheld is produced by Hadar, with special thanks to Rabbi Effie Unterman, Mara Bronfeld, Sam Greenberg, and Chana Kupitz. Thank you to David Chabinsky for recording and editing this episode.